The Make a Realistic Wish Foundation. Why go to any trouble when they're only going to die anyway?
How long since you took ecstasy?
I have done nothing wrong. I have nothing to apologise for.
I would never seek to make light of the death of an Australian soldier.
He's quoted as saying that women who don't wear the hijab or headdress are like uncovered meat.
I'm not homophobic at all. I have a lot of gay friends.
This is an art exhibition in Sydney that is causing quite a stir. These are images from Bill Henson.
It's the first time I've seen them. I find them absolutely revolting. Kids deserve to have the innocence of their childhood protected. Whatever the artistic view of the merits of that sort of stuff, frankly, I don't think there are any. Just allow kids to be kids, you know?
I hope we didn't just shock you too much for this early on a Saturday morning. You were just listening to people like The Chaser, Verity Firth, Tony Abbott, Stephanie Rice and more break a myriad of cultural taboos in the media. Some social no-nos, like joking about dying children, go without saying. But others are a little bit less obvious. Hello and welcome to All the Best this Saturday morning. On today's show, we're going to be talking about some of those taboos. In fact, everything on today's show might shock you a little bit at first. On the show, we'll hear about a sex worker for people with a disability, hear from somebody who jokes about rape and the Holocaust for a living, and debunk the myth of Indigenous Australian cannibalism.
Stories from Sydney. This is All the Best on FBI.
Whilst the taboo surrounding being gay has started to fade in recent years in this country, unfortunately there are many environments in which someone's sexuality can still be a problem. It's no secret that some churches strongly disapprove of homosexuality, something that can be pretty tough for young Christians who realise that they themselves are gay. Ben and Sam are a young couple from Sydney who are both Christian. They sat down with Adam Zui to tell their stories of how they reconciled their homosexuality with their religion.
Ben Gresham had always described himself as Christian, but he started taking his religion seriously in his mid-teens. He began to attend church regularly. First, it was the church that his family went to, a small Anglican congregation. But later, Ben's schoolmates took him to Hillsong, a megachurch filled with young people praying together.
It almost seemed it was the church where anything was possible. It was a church where, you know, if you wanted something, if you prayed hard enough, and if you believed hard enough, and you believed it was in God's will for you to have something, then you would expect it to happen. And if it could happen, it would happen at that church.
Was there something that you were wanting to happen?
I think so. I think underlying my faith was kind of like I knew I was gay.
Now, being gay was a big issue for a young Christian like Ben. The churches he attended were conservative and traditional. They didn't tolerate homosexuality. To say that being gay was taboo is a bit of an understatement. It was an abomination, a sin. Ben had grown up hearing these statements, and he believed them strongly.
They told you that you would go to hell and that you wouldn't be in a relationship with God anymore, and so for me, at the time, you know, God was my everything. I thought that if I, you know, accepted this, if I came out, if I couldn't change, that my relationship with God wouldn't be there anymore, and that I wouldn't be able to be loved because I turned against Him.
Needless to say, Ben wasn't open with others about his sexual orientation, and he desperately wanted to change. He told me that, to some extent, he was depending on God to change him, to make him into the man that he thought God wanted him to be, a straight man. That's what prompted Ben to enroll in ex-gay therapy.
Ex-gay programs are programs that try to change you from gay to straight.
Every day he would have to answer a series of questions.
Had you had thoughts about other men? Had you masturbated today? Had you looked at pornography? had you had impure thoughts?
And if you answered yes to any of these questions, you had to explain why you had failed and how you would be accountable to God. At one point, Ben hadn't masturbated for 3 months, which is no mean feat for a 16-year-old guy. But one day...
I finally slipped and I gave in, and that was... You know, I fell on my knees. You know, I remember I was at home and I literally fell on my knees in the bathroom, and I just started crying, and I cried and I cried and I cried for probably about half an hour, and I just felt like a complete failure. And I was so scared because I knew that, you know, tomorrow I needed to actually, you know, tell my leader that I'd done this. And after 3 months and I'd been so good and I was making progress and I was doing so well, and you know, and then I stuffed up.
It was this intense pressure and guilt that drove Ben to self-harm and 2 suicide attempts.
I don't know how I survived any of them, to be honest. It was so close. I remember crying out to God though after my second attempt, and I just it was almost in that moment I knew that he loved me, and I don't know what it was, but I just remember that, I just remember crying out to him, and for the first time in my life, I actually felt that I was loved by God exactly as I was, completely and wholly, and that as a gay man, that there was nothing really wrong with me.
Ben now has a boyfriend named Sam. He's also a Christian, and like Ben, he had a hard time coming to terms with his homosexuality. His story is quite different to Ben's, although it's no less troubling. Sam came from a small country town, where he was a youth pastor and even started his own church at age 20. But he knew he was gay, and when he was down in Sydney for a conference, he had a sexual experience with another guy.
I slipped up, and I had a moral failure, which is what we call it in the church.
To Sam, the right thing to do was to confess his sin. So he called up a senior colleague and told her what had happened. He was referred to an ex-gay program, like the ones Ben had participated in. But when he spoke to the director of the program...
It didn't sit with me. I just thought, he sounds, you know, a little bit too gay for my liking, for someone who's apparently been changed and transformed and is living a straight life.
He decided to decline ex-gay treatment. And that's when things got a bit crazy, because his community interpreted his decision as a choice to willingly live in sin.
So then I was told I was demon-possessed and that I would need deliverance ministry, which is essentially like an exorcism, but less kind of ritualistic. I was told that if I was to stay in the church and keep doing what I was doing in the church, that eventually people would start to die because I had spirits. I came home one Sunday and I literally just broke down. I literally started sobbing because I couldn't handle it anymore. And I thought the only way that I'm going to escape this is if I just leave and just leave completely.
And so he left and came to live here in Sydney. That was 2 years ago. Ben and Sam met about a year ago, and they're pretty thrilled to have found each other. But what's most amazing to me is that these 2 impressive young guys still have such strong faith. After all, their churches had put them through so much trauma. I asked Ben how he maintains his belief, and how exactly he reconciles his homosexuality with his Christianity.
In the end of the day, it's all about love. There's this verse where God says, you know, there are only 2 commands, and you fulfill these, and you've pretty much got life sorted. And he said, you love God and love other people. I totally believe, with all my heart, that God loves a gay, you know, the gay and lesbian community so much. That is without a shadow of doubt, I believe that. And back then, I thought he didn't make me straight because he was punishing me for something or I wasn't a good enough person. But now I realise that he didn't do that and he didn't make me straight because there was absolutely nothing wrong with me in the first place.
Even though homosexuality is still shunned in some churches, the taboo is disappearing fast. For instance, Hillsong no longer runs the ex-gay programs that caused Ben so much misery in his late teens. And Ben is optimistic that the church will continue making progress. This is his vision.
I wish that gay and lesbian people could just turn up to a church on a Sunday, you know, say with their partner, and just turn up and sit down, and there's nothing, you know, said that's going to hurt them. There's nothing negative said about them. There's nothing negative preached from the pulpit, but it's all just a welcoming environment, and they're loved for who they are, and they're accepted exactly where they are. I think when that gets to the point, you know, then the church will finally have moved forward a little bit on this issue.
That was Ben Grisham speaking to Adam Zwee. Ben is the youth coordinator of Freedom to Be, an organisation that assists LGBT people from Christian backgrounds on their journey to reconcile their faith and their sexuality. You also heard Ben's boyfriend, Sam Griebert, who runs a Bible study group for LGBT Christians. We'll pop links to both of those groups up on the All the Best page over at fbiradio.com. And if you or anybody you know is struggling with depression, be it from being gay, being conflicted with religion, or any other reason, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. For further information, contact Beyond Blue or talk to your GP, local health professional, or someone you trust. You're listening to All the Best this morning, where we are exploring the world of taboo. Up now, Smokey Taboo from Coco Rosie. We did just hear from Coco Rosie on FBI this morning. We're on All the Best. We are exploring a taboo. Now, anthropologists have identified many different taboos from across the world. Stuff like taking drugs, having big feet, showing too much skin, farting at the dinner table. But when you look through all times and places in modern history, they say there's three cultural stigmas which abound. Pedophilia of young children is one, as is incest. The third, which you'll hear about today at some length, is even more difficult to stomach, quite literally. Cannibalism. There has been a bit of historical documentation to suggest that some Papuan tribes used to practice this, as infamously chased up by Today Tonight some years ago in an example of journalism that should have itself been taboo. But apart from these rare examples and maybe a couple of deserted island horror stories, there's not that many concrete stories about people eating people, only rumours. Which takes us to the early 1800s in Australia, a time of imperial colonial expansion. Britain, France, and Holland engaged in voyages of discovery to find out, among other things, if Indigenous peoples were savages and cannibals. To discover cannibals, they thought, they would be discovering people who were least like themselves. Despite recorded instances where Indigenous Australians responded with revulsion at the idea of cannibalism when broached by colonialists, myths surrounding the practice of Indigenous Australia, whether they be for survivalist or traditional purposes, endured. UTS Associate Professor of Law, Catherine Biber, has conducted research into this unsavoury part of Australia's early history, exploring why, in lieu of concrete evidence, myths of Indigenous cannibalism existed and from where the colonialists' fascination stemmed. In this next piece, she relays the story of an Indigenous man wrongly accused of murder and cannibalism to highlight her findings.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
I'm not loving you.
On the 23rd of December in 1826, on the New South Wales frontier, a white shepherd named Henry Preston went to his employer, John Jamieson, to collect his weekly rations. Neither Preston nor his dog returned home, and another shepherd raised the alarm. A brief search yielded nothing. Foul play was feared and suspicion fell upon a group of local Aborigines. The magistrate was not at home and the district constable, although summoned, did not arrive. A rumour circulated that the Aborigines had been seen with sugar rations. Jamieson decided to take the matter into his own hands. He left home with two armed men, rode to Wallandilly and rounded up 10 Aborigines, 2 men, 3 women, a girl and 4 boys. He charged them with killing his servant and took them prisoner. He claimed that 4 of the children admitted that Preston had been murdered, but that the murderer had gone to Bong Bong after cutting up his victim and burying the dog. Jamieson and his men headed for Bong Bong. On seeing them, the suspect, known as Hole in the Book, and a woman, known as his gin, attempted to flee. Hole in the Book was captured, and when the charges were laid upon him and a rope was produced, he ran. Jamieson fired 2 shots and Hole in the Book fell dead. Returning home, Jamieson interrogated his Aboriginal prisoners as to the whereabouts of Preston's body. He was told that Preston had been cut into pieces, roasted and eaten. So was his dog. Bones and entrails were produced and Jamieson was shown where the fire was built. Later, a surgeon would testify that the bones were a shin bone, a left collarbone and the lower bone of an arm, all human. On the 3rd of January, 1827, John Jamieson wrote to Governor Darling, detailing these events. Several days later, Henry Preston walked out of the bush unharmed. He had been lost in the bush, wandering 80 miles from the station. In May, Jamieson was tried for the manslaughter of Hole in the Book. The trial aroused public interest, partly because of the allegations of cannibalism and partly out of surprise that Jamieson had been charged at all. Justice Stevens, in his directions to the jury, said, "It should never be understood for a moment that the natives are not equally under the protection of the laws with any of His Majesty's subjects in the colony." The jury returned an immediate verdict of not guilty by reason of justifiable homicide. Jamieson's trial accorded with contemporaneous judicial sentiment that the English common law must offer the same protections to both settlers and natives. His acquittal accorded with public sentiment that the killing of an Aborigine did not attract criminal sanction. To me, what's interesting about that story is that the allegations of cannibalism turned out not to be true. So there is no credible evidence to suggest that Indigenous Australians were ever cannibals, and yet there is a long history in which white colonists have believed that it was possible that Indigenous Australians might be cannibals. So I suppose what this story tells us is that in the absence of any credible evidence, the belief is very tightly held and compelling and says a lot about entrenched notions of Indigenous people and beliefs that we might, and practices that we might regard as taboo or atavistic or savage in some way. I think there is probably a small but significant fraction of the community that believes that Aboriginal people have in their past practiced cannibalism. Certainly there are cannibalistic practices amongst other Indigenous peoples in the Pacific, and that evidence is credible and scholarly and has been disclosed. But certainly about Aboriginal Australians, that evidence is not compelling or true. But certainly there are instances, political instances today, where those allegations seem to rise up and have some kind of weight. I suppose the most well-known, relatively recent instance was when a book that was attributed to Pauline Hanson, although she didn't write it, called The Truth, reproduced a lot of those old, unfounded allegations about Indigenous people, that Indigenous people did kill and eat their babies, that Indigenous people did kill and eat their enemies, that Indigenous people did kill and eat out of survivalism.
UTS Associate Professor of Law, Catherine Bybot, talking to Alicia Hamilton about cannibalism. And why are we talking about people eating each other? On today's show, we're exploring the things often left off radio, the taboo topics that no one really wants to talk about. Coming up soon, you'll hear the story of a sex worker who works with the disabled community, plus we'll meet a dude who jokes about the unjokeable, rape and the Holocaust. All that and more on FBI 94.5, where you are listening to All the Best.
Champagne and it tastes just like cherry cola, C-O-L-A cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and it was that bro. Let's talk about you, you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. A little bit, a little bit.
We'll be doing that in not too long on All the Best this morning. Talking about sex, we did just hear Salt and Pepper, and before it, Lola by the Kinks. A song, two songs, I guess, that were both at the time of release definitely covering an area of taboo, which is what we're about this morning on FBI, where all of our stories come to you with a little bit of to them.
All the Best.
Stories from Sydney.
On FBI.
Comedians have long used taboo topics to make people laugh. There's not one comedian I can think of who hasn't used areas of taboo to warm to the audience or completely gross them out. And rightly so, there's nothing to say that an audience won't respond with shock rather than laughter when topics such as rape or terrorism are thrown up in the comedic sphere. One local Sydney person who has experienced a tough crowd whilst broaching these subjects is Rhys Nicholson. The young comedian is known for his anti-censorship attitude towards telling taboo off-topic jokes. In this next piece, you'll hear some of them. And along with areas of, with pretty taboo areas, there's some quite strong language here too.
Hey, look, I'll be honest. I'm fucking mad for cock, right? Love it, coming at me at all angles. Maybe a couple of cocks, on a plate, bit of parsley, bit of cock garnish.
My name is Rhys Nicholson, and I'm a comedian, kind of.
Back of my throat, flawless.
I think you can just find a certain crowd that you can just taboo the fuck out of anything. Stuff like rape and pedophilia and all that kind of stuff, people tend to get pretty freaked out about as soon as you even mention it, even if you have a context around it. Also, people seem to get a bit freaked out about the Holocaust. I don't know why. It's been a long time. They would have been dead by now anyway. I have a joke about NRL footballers being rapists and being gay rapists, basically. There was that big sex scandal involving like 10 guys. And I used to have a bit about in the joke where I would say, because that girl, apparently all the media, all the footballers were saying, yeah, well, apparently she was at work gloating about how she, you know, had fucked all these footballers the night before. And I used to say, well, no, that can't be true because, you know, the back of her throat would have been so bruised. She could barely speak, let alone gloat. But now I've kind of turned it into saying that there's no reason for that girl to be there. She's basically there to hold the jizz.
She's playing the terrifying role of the sock that every guy keeps under his bed. She's like a sham wow for jizz.
Weirdly, people clap at calling a rape victim a sham wow for jizz. I don't know why, but it works. If I'm going to push boundaries, I want to do it for a reason. I will do like a rape joke or something, not to make fun of rape, but to kind of just, it's a thing that we can talk about. There's so many things that we should be able to talk about that we obviously can't. A good comedian comments about what's going on and puts our spin on things because the news doesn't. Whereas, you know, the news, if it's a good news channel, will just tell you what happened. We can kind of put our spin on it, what we think and what we think that you should think, but without being preachy.
Look, I want to talk to you a little bit about religion. Comedians don't touch it. Let's break down some comedic barriers. I have this really vivid memory, right?
We need to get a point where things are okay to be covered and that you know, you can talk about it without being terrified that you're going to be vilified. Like, not desensitized, obviously, like, things like rape and pedophilia, it's not like a... We shouldn't be at a state where we're like, well, that's okay. Rape this chick on the weekend. Oh, fuck, she needed it. I did a gig where it was sold to me as a comedy night, a late night comedy night. It wasn't. It was a lesbian spoken word slash burlesque evening. And then they just kind of put me in the middle of it. And a woman before me read a poem about how she was raped. And then I had to come on. That's the only gig I think I've ever done where I feared for my life.
After hearing that, I'm pretty sure karma does exist. That was Sydney comedian Reese Nicholson broaching many a taboo topic. If you were squirming in your seat through that, you were in good company. We all were too here at FBI. The local funny man recently participated in a debate at the Sydney Comedy Festival. The topic was that there shouldn't be any censorship in comedy. Reese was placed on the opposition. Needless to say, his team had to forfeit by the end of the debate. That piece was produced by Rowan Sood. You're on All the Best this morning, where we are exploring the topic of taboo. Coming up soon, we cover one of the most taboo topics, sex, to get us there. Here's a song from Anthony and the Johnsons, one of the only highly visible, openly transsexual musicians in contemporary music. This song is about Anthony's transition.
My lady's story, my lady's story.
You're listening to All the Best, Stories from Sydney on FBI.
Some people need a little bit of assistance. So if someone's non-verbal and just uses a communication board or just uses yes, no, nodding or uses their eyes in different ways to communicate, then someone else can make the appointment on their behalf. I've had mothers or fathers and brothers and support workers all ring me and say, hi, I'm ringing up on the behalf of such and such. I got your number from XYZ and such is looking for a sex worker to provide these services. Would you be willing to come out and see him? He lives here.
There's pretty much only one topic I don't talk about with my parents, and that's sex. But imagine having to rely on your parents to hook it up for you. When we're talking taboo, that's a don't touch kind of topic. In our next story, we meet Rachel Wadden, a sex worker who is often engaged by parents for their kids, among other people. Rachel works with people with a disability and speaks here with Liam Neerham.
I was drawn to the area of sexuality and disability as a natural progression in my life, really. And so looking back, there was a lot of energy and focus and a lot of people that I was meeting that were around this interest and issue around sexuality, disability, and also sex workers providing services to some clients with disability. I've been working as a sex worker, seeing clients who with a disability for many years. I'm not really sure when was the first time. I mean, within the 17 years, in the last 10 years since I've assisted with setting up Touching Base as an organisation, obviously there's been an increase in the number of clientele who I've been seeing with a disability. But definitely before that, people have always self-referred or family members have assisted people to make contact with sex workers. And it's quite diverse, just like the range of different disabilities one can have in society. I think sexuality and disability is really seen as a taboo subject because for many years, much like sex workers, people with disability have been stigmatised and had to live with a lot of discrimination and fallacy about who they are. They've either been seen completely asexually, that because they may not be able to verbally communicate with someone, therefore, for some reason, people think that they don't have sexual needs like anyone else, or on the complete opposite, they're seen as highly sexualized children, and all of that is completely wrong. So, just like anyone else, people with disability have the full range of needs and desires in terms of sexual expression as anyone else in society. But if people don't take the time to learn about people who are different to them and learn about topics that they don't come in contact with on a day-to-day basis, instead of taking the time out, people make stuff up or just don't think about it at all. And this is how these taboos happen. And I always say to people, We're only one car accident away from being in the exact same position. Touching Base was set up in late 2000 with a number of sex workers and people with disability and people in organisations supporting the sex industry and also many from the disability fields. And it was to bring two marginalised communities, people with disabilities and sex workers, together to fight for our combined rights, to fight for our sexual rights, our human rights, our industrial rights, and the right for sexual expression. One of the greatest myths when Touching Base is asked to present, or any one of us who are sex workers who see clients with disability, one of the things we always want to really reiterate is that this is just one option for everyone. Not all people with disabilities will ever want to see a sex worker. There's millions and millions of people who happen to have a disability in the world who are in loving marriages and relationships, who are dating, who are happily single. But it is an option, and it should be seen as a viable option for people if they so choose. Just like any able-bodied person can choose to see a sex worker if they like. People ask me about what is the benefit of someone seeing a sex worker when they have a disability. And first of all, I go back to, well, they're human. They have needs like anyone else. And so I always often say that the skin is the largest organ of the body. And we always get told that we should eat more fruit and vegetables, we shouldn't smoke, we should drink less, and we should look after our health, do more exercise. But if the skin is the largest organ of the body, then we should also take a bit of time to look after it. And everyone likes to be caressed and touched. And for some people, they don't get a lot of the actual physical contact except for when they're getting washed or transferred or dressed or fed. And so I really like to be able to enjoy being able to touch someone all over. And I think it's a mutually consenting activity. It brings a smile to their face, and therefore it brings a smile to my face. For some people with certain disabilities, the reality of their lifespan is a lot shorter. And so for some parents of these gentlemen, they've really tried hard to really assist them in terms of their sexual needs, because they can't put it off, they can't put it into the too hard basket. They may only have 3 or 4 or 1 year left to live because of the type of disability that they have. And these parents who have assisted their offspring to be able to experience any kind of sexual expression before they pass away are really brave and fantastic parents. And I've had the opportunity to be able to provide a bit of pleasure to a couple of different clientele before they've passed away. One was much younger than the other, and both times were very sad afterwards. At the time, obviously, you never know when someone's going to pass away, and certainly with my younger clientele, I certainly had no idea that he was going to pass away not long after I'd seen him. But it was a real privilege to know that he was so happy and excited about having seen me, that he was just like all his mates, that he got to experience what they'd been talking about. And for him, you know, just like a lot of youth these days, it's a milestone, and it's a rite of passage to be able to feel, you know, a chick and to have, you know, some sexual pleasure. I've really enjoyed my years being a sex worker. Every client is different. The services that I provide are different often. What I do like is, just like with a lot of different occupations, I learn from every client. It's allowed me to make sure that I don't take anything for granted, and that I like to try to acknowledge everything every day, that because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Rachel Wadden, a sex worker and advocate for the rights of people with a disability. Rachel's incredible story has just been put to screen via a documentary, The Scarlet Road, which recently played to a sold-out audience at the Sydney Film Festival and will feature on SBS later this year. The producer of that piece, Liam Neerham, is part of the film. That is it for today's program. Thanks so much for joining me this morning. Thanks to all of our guests on the show today and to our contributors, Aaron Holohan, Adam Zwei, Rowan Sood, and Liam Neerham and Alicia Hamilton. Our show today was produced by Amelia Turzen. All the Best is produced by myself and Jesse Cox and our executive producer, Bridget Dagg. Make sure you join us next week.
Think about this, okay? Imagine a time where you're having great sex with the most ideal woman in the world. How do you feel?
Pretty good.
Okay. How do you feel when you're single, lonely, and you're not meeting any girls?
Probably not as good.
That's what the dating coach often, a lot of these dating coaches will give you the confidence and the mindset to be able to go, she just doesn't know who I am yet.
Have you ever thought you sucked at picking up? Have you ever been in love only to have your love not returned? On All the Best next week, we explore the many facets of unrequited love. We take advice from a dating coach, listen to now well-known writer's angsty teen diary readings, explore the ups and downs of polyamorous relationships, learn how to write the perfect love song, and bury ourselves in the oral histories of one of our contributors' grandmas, who has forgotten who he is. Plus, we'll be taking your love song dedications throughout the show. Don't worry, they can be anonymous, but we want you to program the music of our unrequited love program next week. Just email us with your dedication. Come on, we know you have one. allthebest@fbiradio.com is where you need to email. I'll say it again so you can grab a pen, write it down. allthebest@fbiradio.com. Tell us your unrequited love song dedication.
Stories from Sydney. This is All the Best on FBI.